Oh, but neither one of them? Okay.
City of Long Branch.
I knew they weren't coming, so I thought, well, let's just pull you guys in together.
Excellent. That's good.
No, I see your little suitcase bills in other ways, that's why I like.
I know Jerry's not coming, I have him up in Greece, but I doubt she'll.
I just figured.
Good morning, everyone. We're here in a work session to discuss the, primarily to discuss the budgets for both the police and fire department. We'd like to begin the meeting, the Lone Peak Public Safety District Board meeting agenda, meeting for Thursday, February 28th, and I've asked Ruan Beck if he would offer the invocation.
Our Father in Heaven, this morning, we're grateful to exercise our constitutional rights here in the form of a city meeting, and we pray that thy spirit will be with us and help us, that we'll get along well, bless the chiefs, that they'll present well, help us to make best decisions for our combined communities. We're thankful again for the opportunities, Father, that we have in this free country, and pray again for all of our leaders and those around us, and ask thee to help us during this next hour or so in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
Amen. Thank you very much.
There's Troy. We're good.
Oh, good. We've reserved some time for the public to give us any comments or input, and we've scheduled that time for now. Is there anyone from the public that would like to share their thoughts? Okay. Good morning, Mayor. I'm glad to have you here.
Good morning. I apologize
for the
noise.
No problem. Yeah, good.
I have a clock that lies. No excuse,
but it's true. See, Mayor.
We're just glad to have you here, Mayor.
Did your dog take your homework too?
Yeah, that happened.
Okay. First of all, I do want to apologize to Chief Thompson for our last meeting when we didn't get enough time to really give him the amount of time he needed, which frankly I think we need this work session to discuss both budgets. So I'm going to turn the time now over to Chief Thompson and give you the time that you need.
Thank you very much.
And frankly, the people that are going to be voting on this
are here. Okay. That's always a good thing, right?
So,
okay. We have a paper version of the slides in front of you as well. So for some reason, our technology gives us some challenges. We have the backup plan here. Just get started here. As we looked at the budget proposal for this year, I always start with what's the purpose. I've listed there our services that are provided. The core services relevant to the fire and EMS portion of the public safety district, largely handled with fire suppression and emergency medical services. Inside this slide, you'll see the breakdown of the types of fires that we respond to, and then in addition, the quick response and ground ambulance services that are provided. We also provide hazardous materials and technical rescue services for the area, and those disciplines are listed there. That's the bread and butter of what happens day in and day out. We could have anywhere from 10 calls in a 24-hour period to two or three calls in that same window. In addition to those 911 services that are provided, we also have fire prevention programs and community outreach programs that encompass some of the items you'll see in the budget. As it relates to how we build the budget, the determining factors that we use, we look at what's required by law or regulatory compliance, industry standards and best practices, and then what are the expectations that we have from a customer standpoint, and then any other needs that come as it relates to services that are provided to this citizenry.
Chief, do you want to take questions during, or?
I can, certainly.
I just had a question in terms of expectations of the customer. How do we get that information?
That's a great question. We receive feedback from individuals, both sometimes negative and positive, on an individual basis. I think when we respond to 911 calls and out in the community, I think it's tough sometimes with a survey to get information back and know whether we're hitting the mark or not. But I believe, based on what I know of the demographic of the area, I think they anticipate and expect that they're going to have an ambulance and/or a fire truck show up at their home when it's needed. And in order to do that, it requires that we staff it appropriately. And so if we're not meeting the needs of the customer, I would tend to think we'd hear more about that. We're not hearing a whole lot right now, and so maybe that's an assumption on my part, but I think
no news is good news.
People are happy with the services provided. But that is a tough question to answer, in that I'm not sure entirely if we know exactly what our expectations of the customer are. But we try to meet those
needs.
Well,
I think from my just thinking out loud here, response time would be something that we might hear from the public on. If we had a 45-minute delay, we might hear something about that.
Right.
So it's getting down to what is that sweet spot in terms of a response time for you. I mean, we could put a fire truck on every corner, mm-hmm. and be there within seconds.
Yeah.
We have actually two stations now. And so it's going to be, what, a maximum of how long and a minimum of how long, do you think?
Under
normal circumstances.
Yeah, under normal circumstances, I would think our benchmark of, a 5 to 6 minute response from the we're notified of the alarm till we arrive on scene.
Five to six minutes.
That would include our...
On average.
On average.
Uh-huh.
We have some areas that are on the fringe on the excess side of that, meaning that we are 7 or 8 minutes or even...
You think 8 minutes might be the longest it would be?
I think that based on where the stations are located, that's a reasonable understanding. And that's providing that we're responding lights and siren to the call. There are many calls based on the dispatch details that our crews don't run out with lights and siren, based on it may be a sick person that's more of a minor issue that doesn't require us to push the traffic window, if you will. So when we look at the analytics of it, those are all factored in, and so we have to dig down a little deeper to find out are we hitting the benchmark or not, based on the calls that are lights and siren calls, if you will.
So you don't have to turn lights and sirens on if you don't want.
No, it's a lot of it's based on the details we're receiving from the call taker at the dispatch center. Certain calls obviously dictate it, breathing problem, cardiac problem, mm-hmm. Something that requires immediate assistance. But there are some that we get that they've indicated that they've, for instance, an elderly person's fallen out of bed. They're not injured to their knowledge, but they need help being put back to their location, and so that wouldn't require an emergent response.
Okay, thank you.
As we look at this, trying to be optimal versus realistic, as you well know, we have some challenges with the exit of Cedar Hills and what the budget impact will be, and I'll get to that a little later in the discussion. But I've really tried to put something together here that both meets our needs and is hopefully something that, as we look going forward, it's an affordable option. This just is some information relevant to call volume. A lot of times call volume is discussed as it relates to the need for emergency services. I've tried to emphasize that whether you have one call or 20 calls within a 24-hour period, that you still have to have someone that responds there. And so some of these costs are going to be there regardless of the volume of calls. But just to give you an idea, we ran a little over 1,300 calls last year, 3.62 calls per day. The, almost half of those were in the Highland area, and then about a call per day and just under a call per day in Alpine and Cedar Hills, respectively. We do have a handful of calls that end up the canyon. It equals out to about a call per week, but that's obviously condensed greater into the summer months. We're up there several times a week in the summertime, but and less during the window that we're in right now, just because of use up in the canyon.
Because of what?
Use in the canyon.
These are campfires, that kind of thing?
This would be mainly emergency medical calls, but some fire calls as well. So,
if somebody falls, breaks their arm, or almost drowns.
Yeah. Snowmobile accident, for instance, is a winter type call that we may go out on, and we coordinate with our with county search and rescue to package the patient and provide the ambulance transport for that. You'll see listed there some aid given to others and aid received by others. Due to the nature of, I guess, the response for the north end of the county, and particularly, we have an interagency agreement, automatic aid agreement with our neighbors, so that when we're already out on a call or we require more manpower or apparatus resources, that they help us and we in turn help them. The aid that we're giving is about 2-to-1 right now, based on last year. That said, we can't do it without them, and likewise, I don't think they can do it without us. So, just to give you an idea, the 2017 volume is listed there as well, and we're pretty flat as far as the calls we had between calendar year 17 and calendar year 18. In looking at what we believe based on the service delivery that needs to be provided and then the staffing level that needs to take place in order to meet the minimums, we're proposing having 8 firefighters on duty per day. This would allow 3 firefighters on the fire apparatus that would run out of Highland, 3 out of Alpine, and then a two-handed ambulance that would be shared between the two cities. We believe that will handle the bulk of what we need to do there. The engine out of Alpine also has transport capabilities, so that provides our backup ambulance, if you will, and then we would rely on mutual aid or automatic aid from our neighbors to deal with that second call. Or beyond that, an incident that requires multiple transports. We have a cross-staffing solution that we deal with as it relates to some of our other aspects of the emergency services provided. We have brush trucks and a water tender, and then our rescue vehicle that handle those types of calls. They're staffed with the same individuals that would be on the frontline fire apparatus and the ambulances, so it would be based on what the call is that dictates whether they essentially jump the crew over to one of those other pieces of apparatus. Just to clarify, those are not staffed with a body on that apparatus solely each day, so it's based on what the call requires. To make this happen, as far as the staffing pool is concerned, we have 15 full-time firefighters that are currently in our model and exist today. That equates to 5 on duty per day with our ABC schedule. So they work 2 on and 2 days on and 4 days off. So that is how that works. In order to fill the 8 spots, that would be 3 part-time individuals on a daily basis around the clock. And to make that happen, we're in that neighborhood of 30 to 40 part-time individuals in order to fill the availability spots there.
Are we at full staff now?
We are full staff with our full-time people, and then our part-time pool is down to 28 right now, so we've got to do a little bit of a hire there to recruit a few additional people to fill the part-time spots. And that's a revolving door for us as people change their status with either a full-time employer or other things like that. That part-time pool kind of revolves for us. Just to give you an idea of what the staffing would need to be to handle what we call a working structure fire, so fire that's gone beyond the incipient stage or initial stage that would require hose lines and other tactics to put the fire out. These numbers are based on a 2,000 square foot dwelling, which I think we have about four of those in our area. No, I'm kidding, but all kidding aside, we do have larger structures in our service area, but this is based on that information. Takes about 15 firefighters to perform all the duties that are associated with that type of activity. That can be less or more, but that's the average that we're looking at. So with the 8 personnel on duty per day, we're covering about half of those needs and would rely on help from our neighbors to assist with a large working incident or a structure fire, if you will. And the definition there is based on how we would apply and utilize those people in that instance. Next slide deals with a medical call. The instance here is a cardiac arrest. That requires 5 to 6 personnel in order to accomplish what needs to be done to get the patient prepared to go to the receiving hospital. Controlling the airway, make sure we're providing chest compressions. Those require individuals to man that responsibility, someone to establish IV access and provide the cardiac medications needed, someone to monitor or provide a shock through the equipment that we have. And then we have the officer that's in charge of making sure that this goes as it's supposed to go, that things are documented, that we're following protocols, et cetera, gathering patient history and basically make sure the scene is safe for our people to be there as well.
And then Chief, on these staffing levels for both fire and medical, are these industry standards or OSHA requirements?
This would be, I would believe, is what I would call an industry standard. Uh-huh. There are agencies that do that with less. Some of your rural areas, you end up with maybe 2 people that show up on an ambulance. In an urban or suburban setting like we're in, this is pretty much the standard that you'd see in our neighboring communities as well.
But if you didn't have 5, you could still help.
There is some help provided, and then you get into that risk versus benefit balance of, are we doing the best we can for the patient? And I guess maybe back to Mr. Irwin's original question of expectations of the customer, this might be an example that we would use to say, is our expectations being met? Do they anticipate you're just going to get 2 people that are going to show up and take you to the hospital and provide a basic level of service, or are we going to do these advanced life-saving skills in order to try and keep a patient alive and get them to the hospital where they can receive additional care? With the 5 to 6 individuals, you can see that would drain the resources of one station and the ambulance that's associated with that on a single call. With the 8 personnel model that we're proposing, that would leave one fire unit for the district to be able to respond to the second call. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to cover our bases in that respect. To give you an idea of what the staffing levels look like on a compensation side of the house, the money in the budget, largely speaking, is in the personnel and staffing costs. Of the proposed $3.2 million, $2.4 of it is tied up in compensation. That includes the full-time employees and their associated benefits as well, medical, retirement, all of those items. And then it also includes about $450,000 for the part-time employees, and that covers wages only is what that's directed at.
Now, Chief, you've made some changes since you've been here with regard to the various levels. Can you kind of just briefly say what we used to have and what we now have?
Where we were and where we are now?
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. So prior to my arrival, the makeup, there were still 18 full-time positions that were there. Of that, 5 of those positions were what we'd call a chief officer level or administrative position. There was a fire chief, they had that was full-time, 3 full-time battalion chiefs, and a part-time assistant chief. Of the of the compensation budget, that was, those five positions were totaling, just their wages were totaling over $500,000. And so when we looked at the staffing model and what needed to be happen, as I met with Nathan and the other city managers to try and figure out how we make this work, we felt like we had a top-heavy organization based on our call volume. If we were in an area that required larger call volume, I think there is a need for that, I guess, more supervisors or more of an administrative load there. We didn't feel that was optimal or realistic. And so as we did that, we restructured the organization. We have two administrative positions now, a fire chief and a deputy fire chief. And then the captain level is what we'd call the frontline supervisor. So they're running the crew on a day-to-day basis. They're the one that's arriving initially and setting up operations for a fire. And then the chief officers would respond and complement that. So we kind of cut the head off a little bit and restructured the top end of it. That allowed us to push more of that work into the operations side and look at a couple more firefighters that are doing the day-to-day operations and kind of look at a balanced staffing model.
12-hour shifts or 24?
They work 48-hour shifts, so they're on for 2 days and then off for four. That's what the full-time staff.
I'm just trying to get at six captains. You never have two captains on at the same time.
So we do. We have two on at, we have one at each station.
And one in each station.
Yes, so there's.
We have six, so.
Yeah, so there's an A shift, B shift, and C shift. So when A shift works their 2 days, B and C are off. Then gotcha. B shift works their 2 days, and then C shift follows, and it just revolves. So we would have two supervisors on, one per station daily is what we're proposing there. We have to have somebody that drives the heavy apparatus, the fire trucks, and they need to be qualified to do that. They would be listed as one of the firefighters there, and then obviously our paramedics and EMTs that would be on the ambulance. All of our individuals are certified either as a paramedic or EMT, and then they're cross-trained as firefighters as well. Mayor Stout, did you have a question I thought there?
Mine is just a quick one.
Okay.
We also have training budgets and things like that. That's not counted in here. Is that in the remaining $800,000?
That's in the remaining portion of the budget, which would be the operations, what I call the daily operations and maintenance, would be about $560,000 of that. And then our capital costs, which I call our lease payments for equipment and apparatus, that's about $265,000. So the remaining balance that you were referring to.
Mayor Mann, did you have a question? 48 hours a norm, or because I've seen 24 elsewhere, I think, as well.
Yeah, in this area, the everyone else in the valley and in the neighboring valley is on the 48-96 schedule. There are advantages and disadvantages to that, whether you're talking from an employee perspective or a management perspective. I believe if we were to revert to a 24-hour schedule or what they used to call the Kelly schedule, we would see a major issue with retention of our staff. The employees like the 48-96 schedule. Everybody else is on it. And coming from a department that we were one of, when I was at South Jordan, and we were one of the last to make the transition from the Kelly to the 48-96 schedule, we were losing employees at a greater rate than we certainly like to. Because of that, people were jumping and going to other departments. So I from an administrative perspective, I would not recommend going back to a 24-hour shift.
What are the pros and cons?
So as it relates to the, I guess, one of the cons in a larger call volume department would be fatigue of employees. Please don't take this the wrong way, but to a certain extent, they're chained to the job for 2 days straight. They don't get to go somewhere else. They travel as a group, whether that's the inspections or whatever they need to do. They have to be on that apparatus. So there's not a... there's not a break, so to speak, in that 48-hour period. That has
kind of like taking care of kids.
Yeah.
I mean, in some cases,
yeah. I mean, it's an around-the-clock situation. And honestly, they chose the profession, and the plus side of that is they get days off, more days off on the calendar month than an 8-to-5 individual would. They work more hours, but they get more days off in blocks, if that makes
sense.
But
from a financial standpoint, there's really not much difference, I wouldn't think.
The coverage still has to happen regardless. There, and the FLSA schedule, as it relates to how that overtime breaks out, it's equal. So there's not necessarily a financial advantage. I think in some of your larger departments, this schedule has been in place for about a 10-year window when the first department started to do that. So we're just starting to see the wave of data as it relates to what is fatigue doing to these individuals, what are those pros and cons, if you will. I personally, when we originally went to it, I wasn't necessarily in favor of it because I thought there would probably be some long-term effects to employees as a result of this schedule. For a third of their life, they're at the fire station, and to be gone from your family for 2 days in a row creates some additional challenges. So there are some cons to it, but most of the employees like it because when they're off, they have a larger block of time with their family and things like that. They can arrange vacations or work a second job or what have you.
And the part-time, that's a 24-hour shift?
It is. Those are 24s, the way we've got it broken down. Occasionally, we'll have somebody come and work a 12-hour, either the front half or the back half. And some of those employees will work a 48-hour shift as well if they draw those two dates or scheduled for that. But typically, they're 24.
Chief, one of the things that we typically don't think about is the fact that people get sick, people take time off for vacation, people have to go through training and things like that. Can you walk through how you rotate those individuals in and out and the impact it has on your ability to have your stations full when those types of things happen?
You bet. So with the five full-time folks on per day and then the three part-timers, that's on an average day. We may have a day where we have four or five part-timers on and only three full-time people because of vacations, holiday time, etc. The way this works, they work the holiday if they're on duty, but then they may not work Memorial Day as holidays are given, so they get that day as a floater throughout the year. They have 12 holidays, 12-hour blocks of holiday, similar to most other public employees, as that works. But those shifts still need to be covered. And so we found that number is really closer to 4.6 full-time people on per day, and that number of part-timers would go up to 3.4 per day to balance that out over the calendar year. As it relates to training, there are times when we absorb that while the crews are on duty. In most cases, that's how that works. For instance, if they've got vehicle extrication training, we'd take that unit out of service during that period of time and we'd run with less available. There obviously if we get a working incident or something like that, they'd leave training, but we do send people off-site for training activities as well, and so there are days we run with less than nine people in today's numbers or eight people with what's proposed next year. Our goal is to maintain the staffing and absorb the training, but there are times that just isn't physically possible, and so we take that assumed risk to keep and maintain their skill set.
So that for most of it, yes, it did. Most of the time, your training can be done on site.
Yes.
But when it's off site, that's when you're talking about a different kind of impact.
Yeah. For instance, this week we have an individual that's attending a command and control class at the National Fire Academy. He's gone for a week, and then during that week period, we'll miss him during his 48-hour shift. If we're able to backfill that with a part-time employee, then we've done that. But in some cases, the schedule doesn't get filled, and so we take the risk versus benefit. The benefit is we're getting him trained and able to perform his job better when he's here. the losses that were down an individual during the day or potentially down that individual for that shift.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So when you're using, obviously your part-time people have a schedule for the month.
Yes.
But if you have a need, somebody gets sick or, you know, there's a vacation, do you call these part-time folks and the full-time folks and just ask them to volunteer and then?
We do. The schedule for the part-time employees, well, let me back up. The full-time employees, they schedule their vacation in January for the entire year. So they draw those days and only one full-time individual can be off per day. The part-timers submit a schedule a month in advance, so we fill those shifts, and there still are vacancies after everyone submitted their days. That then goes back out continually to try and fill those, but to answer your question about the sick leave issue, we don't know that generally unless it's an anticipated surgery or something like that. If it's somebody has the flu for the day, we don't know that until possibly an hour or two before the shift starts.
And then you just make a phone call.
So then we, through our software program for our scheduler, that goes out. We start to make phone calls, and there are days we fill it, and there are days that we run short based on that. When that happens, we try to schedule back. If we have training that's scheduled that day, we scale that down so that we've got people that can cover the gaps, if you will. That may mean that instead of me going home at night, I stay closer to the area, things of that nature, so we kind of cover our bases that way. So that's the staffing side of the house there. As far as operational expenses, again, we look at what's required by code, rule, law, statute, and address those first. We have to maintain compliance for worker safety and those things, and so that becomes the first leg of the tier. We then look at the industry standard and best practices, and we have some guidance from American Health Association, the National Fire Protection Association, ISO. Those are all third-party standards that are out there that we utilize in our business to make sure we're meeting norms there. And then we'd have local policy or procedure. If there's expectations specific to our area, we look at those as kind of that third tier there. Just to give you an idea of some of the things that we deal with as it relates to regulatory compliance, our structure fire clothing has a 10-year life cycle. We have to maintain those and replace those on a revolving basis. When I got here, we'd received a grant for 14 sets of turnouts. That was very helpful to address some of the budget deficiencies, but we had over 30 pairs of turnouts that in some way, shape, or form were out of compliance when I got here last January. We've since closed that gap, and now we have a rotating system to where hopefully those aren't all hitting in one year, that we're balancing that load out and establishing that. But to give you an idea, a set of structure fire gear per employee is about $2,500.
Chief, I'm just curious, what happens to the retired uniforms or the retired equipment?
So there's a couple of things we can do with it. If they're damaged or to a point where they're not usable at all, then they're taken out of service and discarded. There are agencies out there that don't have, in rural areas, that don't have the ability to fight fires from the interior perspective, meaning they don't have the staffing to go inside, so they do defensive operations. So we've donated some of that gear or surplus that gear to others in need. In fact, we did that with this last wave of gear to an area down in the Kanab area of the state where they don't have any budget, they don't have any means to address some of those issues, and so they still work for with some perspective to defensive operations, but not necessarily what we call offensive operations. So.
Chief, one of the things we want to do is make sure that our employees, the firefighters, have the equipment they need to do their job. So the question I have is, if this time frame is 10 year, which is best practice, we go outside of that time frame, the equipment isn't damaged, but you know it's still functional. What is does the state come in when they inspect us and they slap us on the wrist? Is it really just trying to make sure that we have the right equipment, because it's kind of like a car, after so many miles, you're just not getting the performance, and you know that it starts causing some issues. What happens when you hit that 10-year mark with those clothes, or that gear, and it, you're going past that time frame? What happens?
What happens? So ideally, we would stay in compliance. We are subject, we are an OSHA state. We're subject to OSHA requirements and regulations there.
So is that an OSHA requirement of 10 years?
They require you to be in the appropriate PPE, and they reference in the code, they reference the NFPA standard as the standard that should be followed for that. Ultimately, at the end of the day, I guess unless you have a serious injury or a fatality, most likely you're not going to have the microscope of scrutiny there. But immediately when that does happen, we have protocols that you're to sequester or chain of custody the gear that was used, and there's an outside group called NIOSH that comes in and investigates the work failure or fatality, if you will. And so then they would, if you're out of compliance with that gear, that's where the OSHA compliance would become a major
issue. What triggered it was you said that there were 30 sets that were out of compliance. We're not going to solve all of that in 1 year.
Correct.
So I'm thinking, how is it that we're able to do that? What's the issue of extending and things like that? That was kind of what triggered the
So what we've looked at, based on their use and the wear pattern of what we're seeing, usually we're getting a 5 to 7 year window out of them without having to have repairs done to the equipment. Even just due to their normal wear and tear, the material breaks down over time. It's a light sensitive issue as well. What I've set up now is that we're on a 5 to 7 year rotation, so that way the stuff that's older gets put into a backup set when they get damaged or dirty or soiled and they need to be washed. We have to have a pair of gear that they can go into. And so I've got it set up now to where that revolving window's on that 5 to 7 year window, with 10 being the max. For instance, my gear doesn't get used the way that a normal, I guess, an everyday firefighter's does with coming on and off the rig. Mine's a 10-year rotation, for instance, where we may have somebody that, due to normal wear and tear, that we're only getting 5 to 7 years out of the garment. So we've set that process to be a revolving replacement with a little bit of a cushion in it, with 10 being the maximum we would go to.
Okay.
Not to belabor the issue, but we have several other issues there relating to equipment, our breathing apparatus, our SCBAs, uniforms, things that require that we maintain those in an appropriate way, and they have an expense tied to them. As we look at our apparatus and some of the costs associated with that, we have to maintain the fire pump has to be tested annually. The aerial device has to be tested so that it we don't have a catastrophic failure and have a firefighter fall to the ground with a mechanical failure. The ground ladder, same things have to be tested that way, our hose and extrication equipment. So those are tied into the operations budget. As we look at what the Cedar Hills exit is going to do to us, my assumption based on where we're at currently is that there's going to be a cash out that's associated with their exit. We can do a couple of things with that money. My suggestion would be we look at what debt we have and try to tackle some of the debt snowball there. We are reducing from 9 to 8. The proposal when Cedar Hills was looking at staying, the proposal was to go to from 9 to 11 to address a dedicated ambulance regardless. And so the 8 number there is a reduced number based on that staffing plan. There are a few things in the budget we're able to reduce. Their rent, the utilities associated with that, and we do have a surplus vehicle that we're planning to see if we can get some funding out of when the 1st of July comes around. That'll be the LaFrance fire engine. Some issues not addressed in the budget or the deficits associated with it. There will continue to be operational equipment increases, inflation, things of that nature on supplies and equipment that we have. So that will be an ongoing costs that we'll need to address. Any issues relating to staffing retention? I think we're in market as it relates to wage right now with where we're paying our employees. That was out of balance when I got here with the captains and firefighters. Again, back to the original, we had a lot of folks at the top end that were being paid very well, and the folks at the bottom end weren't. We've balanced that now, but that's something we need to keep our eye on. In the reduction there, the fire marshal position was eliminated. I've absorbed those duties right now and are handling those along with our staff doing the annual business inspections. I would recommend that that's a position we need to replace at some point in time. I would recommend that that doesn't happen this budget year, but that we look at it probably a year from now to look at replacing that. The Tier 2 retirement gap, there is a Senate bill that's made it to the House that there's an effort to address the Tier 2 issue there, but that's something we're keeping an eye on. Our medical coverage, we have great medical benefits here for our employees, but that is, as you well know, are rising costs that sometimes are an unknown for us. We do have an aging fleet. Our ladder truck is almost 11 years old. The life cycle for a typical ladder truck is 10 to 12 years, and we still owe on it for another 6 years. So we've got some challenges with fleet, but I think we can dig our way out of this in a couple of years.
And on that particular item, we're kind of upside down, so to speak. We owe more money than it's worth. What is the differential there?
So currently we owe about $580,000. The two estimates when we sent this out to people to buy fire apparatus were in that $380,000 to $400,000 range. So we're a payment or payment and a half backwards on it. I think there'll be a point in time when we get a little closer to that spot and we can get into a newer piece of equipment for the amount of money we're paying on the loan right now, would be my recommendation.
Okay.
And then we have some capital equipment needs. As our SCBAs, for instance, come up for their replacement cycle, we're a few years out from that, but to replace 18 sets of those, we're in the neighborhood of $300,000 or $400,000 to make that happen. So it's something we need to plan for ahead of time. Got a couple more slides and I'll be brief. The Cedar Hills assessment from last year was their interlocal portion they paid was $755,000. We'll lose approximately $130,000 in ambulance revenue with their exit because those will go to American Fork. So rough numbers, we're about $885,000 short of where we were last year. We have and still have similar needs. Granted, we're losing a fire station, but we still have staffing and apparatus and operations costs to deal with. After combing through the budget, there's just under $100,000 we're able to trim out of that. So there's a gap of just under $800,000 that's problematic for us. As we look at the next slide, as I mentioned, there's an opportunity, I think, to close the gap with either some sort of fee or increase. If we look at that based on a person per month, it's about, based on our population, that's about $2.20. If we look at per ERU, it's right around $8.50 per month. I think that's not a huge amount of money when we talk about a per month per person cost or per ERU. I think it's reasonable. I think our budget is reasonable, but obviously there's a gap there that needs to be addressed, and that's my goal is to just provide you the appropriate information so you can make an informed decision.
Chief, with the reduction of one station and that staffing being reduced, how does that work in terms of, are we adding staff to the other two that we don't have the reduction, or how does that happen?
So the current model that we were running is three at each station, so three at Highland, three at Alpine, three at Cedar Hills. With the Cedar Hills ambulance, because they have the least amount of call volume and the least amount of calls in their area, and in some respects, they have closer response from our neighbors. The way we'd set the staffing model up is that the ambulance was coming out of Cedar Hills on all calls. So they were running a jump crew to where they would either, based on the type of call, if it's a medical call, they're going in the ambulance, and they're providing the ambulance service to the entire district, Alpine Highlands, Cedar Hills. If it's a fire in Cedar Hills area, then they were moving their gear over to the engine and responding in the fire engine.
So you're just moving that ambulance straight across to the other two?
Yeah, so essentially, we still have to have an ambulance that handles the day-to-day needs for medical calls. And so essentially, two of those three spots that were at Cedar Hills need to come over to handle the remaining two cities' emergency medical ground transport calls. So. So some may have thought we're now two of three, so there should be a third cut to this. That's just not how the system's set up to run. And so we have looked at where we can cut and where we can make adjustments, but in order to provide the service level that I believe is needed, that's where we came to. Real briefly, last year we were able to generate some money through the Wildland program. We sent individuals out, both in-state and out-of-state. We were able to gross about $222,000. The net on that was about $138,000. That was, as we met last month, that money was pushed to replace fleet. We're replacing a brush truck. Our goal would be to continue with that process, and if we have a, however you deem it, a good year or a bad year as it relates to fires, we see that as a source to bring some money back in. We are applying for grants. We've applied for the Assistance to Firefighter grant for our replacement of some communications equipment. We're hopeful that that takes place, but we can't bank on that happening, but I think that's an opportunity to offset some costs. At some point, I'd like to come back to the group with a discussion about fees for certain services, standby services, business inspections, but that can be at a later date. But I think there's an opportunity to address some of those. And then with our wildland urban interface, I think there are some opportunities for us to meet and work with citizens to help with defensible space. When we do have what we would call our downtime, meaning we're not out on calls, we can schedule to come and help brush out an area or chip an area, whether that be on the trail system, whether that be in some of our parks or for individuals there. And I think we could charge for those services and generate some costs associated with that, or generate some funding for that.
Would you be charging the cities or the residents?
I guess if it's a city project, then and they have budget for trail maintenance or something like that, then that potentially could be a cost there. There are grants available for some of that opportunity as well. But as far as the citizens are concerned, yeah, we have some areas that they've let the scrub oak go right up to the windows, and maybe it's just an issue of they don't have a resource to get that, have some assistance provided for that. And we would like the opportunity to help out with that.
Chief. The next slide is for questions from the
yes.
board. I know that Rulon has a commitment, so I'd like to be sure that we get all the questions in.
The only question I had was, you know, you come on here now, and now we've got the city going out, and we got the coverage we need. I think Brian mentioned that, and is this a one-time budget hit, or is this going to have keep?
My answer to that would be that I believe this is a one-time issue that needs to be resolved. Going forward, I think the operations budget that we put together, it's data driven, and I think the only increases we'd be looking at would be inflationary costs.
I realize you can't guess everything or pick everything, but just in general, this is $800,000 is something we got to sell.
It's a big impact, and I understand that.
Yeah.
But I wanted to provide you with the best information I could. So.
With that additional revenue from supporting other agencies, you said the net was $130,000-ish.
Mm-hmm.
Does that include the cost, the other piece, does that include the cost of coverage while they're out? Is that other kinds of, what is the difference?
Yes, largely in part, it covered all expenses. So we, when we went to California last year, we backfilled those positions.
And that was, the backfill costs were taken out, and that's when you're talking that?
Correct. So that's the difference between the gross and the net there, is that it covered the employee expenses, it covered our equipment, any damages to equipment and things of that nature.
So one, a comment that I would make is, I don't think that a $790,000 budget adjustment is easy for residents to understand, and I think it would be really important for us to break that down into why.
Okay.
Because it sounds like a fire station or a station is leaving, and our costs are going up significantly, and there should be some reduction, and $90,000 is not what anybody would expect. And it's not, I mean, we've talked enough that I understand what's behind those numbers, but residents are the ones that haven't had that conversation, and I think we need to break it down into a clear picture of why those numbers exist. And it's just not a number, it is, here are the reasons. And without that, I think we're going to get a lot of resistance from residents. I think if we communicate well what that is and why it's there, and along with the question here, the statement of, is this a one-time? It's not a one-year one-time, it's a one-time increase, and then inflation and other types of things.
That's true.
But why is that happening? What caused that to happen? You know, and one of the key elements is, if Cedar Hills was still here, we would have still seen an increase.
Yeah, probably a couple $100,000 increase, $200,000 to $300,000.
And most people wouldn't see that, because what's happening in their eyes is, we were doing just fine. This location disappeared, and all of a sudden we get this huge increase.
Right.
Without understanding that background. And I think that that's going to be really important for us to get clarity on that, so that we can share that with residents as we communicate this. Because, you know, a $102 increase per year is enough that it's going to raise eyebrows, and they should. They should have the interest and desire to know that we are spending their money wisely and what that really means. So I need that information for myself in communication. I think all of us on this board and the city councils in each of the cities need to have that communication. It's not that it's wrong. Is that we need the clarity of what that entails and why. And the why is probably more critical, because had they not left, again, we would have seen even a bigger increase, because we would have had, you know, them paying a portion of it, but it was an increase needed just because we were behind.
Right.
One of the things that Harlan did in the last couple of years is go out to the public and talk about our roads. Now, one of the advantages that we had with the roads is everybody could see the roads needed to be improved and maintained and fixed. Most people see the fire department, police department as doing just fine. So we have another additional nut to crack, and that's, I totally agree with what Brian is saying. We've got to just be able to talk about it and justify it in our own minds first, and then to the public. And the chief has been gracious enough to invite members of the board to come in and talk with him. If you haven't had that opportunity, please take it, because it's really good information that he's providing. And so I want to open it up for more questions.
I don't really have any questions.
The chief and I have met and talked things through, and I feel comfortable that his assessment of what we need is accurate, is good, it's healthy. I, like everyone else, what I'm not comfortable with is how we're going to do it. And I think Brian brought up a great point. It's the public's ability to digest the reasons. And what it all comes down to is public safety. And I think if government has, if you're going to prioritize our responsibilities, public safety is number one. And so how do we balance that with the strong desire within the community to not spend any more money? I think we, and then the members of our community, are going to have to ask ourselves some tough questions. You know, how badly do we want up to standard equipment, up to standard training, capital equipment that is significantly capable of handling worst-case scenario. And you know, ask that question. What are you willing to do?
Yeah, and I think the issue that Brian brought up earlier, and that is we do want our firefighters to have up-to-date equipment, have the equipment that they need to do the job. Because frankly, if a firefighter goes out to an incident and doesn't have the equipment, a lot of times that blame gets pushed onto the fire department. It's not your fault. We have to provide that information, that equipment for them. So,
well, there may be some help by Mother Nature.
There may be.
The recent earthquake frenzy has caused some people to wonder what's going to happen, and may need to bring home the fact that we need to be safe.
Yeah.
I have before you. I have a summary page of the budget. I have the detailed budget is available for you. I did not print that off for you today, but I'm happy to send that your direction. That way, it goes into line by line what where these costs are going, and happy to provide that to you.
So just so we're clear, Chief, it's not so much identifying the dollars. It's describing
what did
why
the
there's
do?
A difference. It's the why, not the specific.
Yeah.
Okay. And I'm happy to do whatever we need. If that's pushing information out through media outlets, social media, having open houses, whatever we need to do to get the information, the water to the end of the row, I'm willing and more than happy to do that.
And I think each council, Alpine, Highland, is going to have to have this discussion. It's going to be up to us, frankly, to take it back to our councils and talk about it and get the support of the full council.
Okay.
So this is a significant portion of the personnel cost relates to the dedicated ambulance. If we took that out and said, we'll staff an ambulance out of the fire equipment.
Existing fire equipment, yeah.
Then I've just lost the need for two people full-time, right? How does that impact our ability to respond? Because you're essentially one station or the other would be acting at an ambulance on a call.
Yes.
And then what's the impact? Because that's a really big increase on top of it. We had a sizable increase last year for you, right? And we're doing it again.
Yeah.
That's something that will come up and we'll have to defend. And so why can't you just staff an ambulance out of the instead of having a dedicated ambulance?
I guess my answer to that would be we leave no ability to respond to the second call in our community whatsoever. So on a standard medical call, you get a basic life support response out of the fire unit and an advanced life support and ground ambulance transport out of the ambulance.
Okay.
If we take two people out of the equation and reduce to six instead of eight, now those individuals go on the first call. There's no one in the entire district to handle a second call, whether that be medical, fire, any other type of call, and we rely solely on our neighbors to come in and bail us out. The bailout comes with a cost as well, in that they're now 10, 12, 15, 20 minutes away, and in a cardiac arrest situation or a breathing problem situation, that's a life or death situation. Somebody dies as a result of that. So I guess it comes to the question of, and I know actuaries do this with insurance and things like that all the time, but it comes down to, are we here to provide life safety response to the community, or are we okay with a lesser level of service to our community? I would suggest, based on the demographic, they expect that when they call 911, they're going to get an adequate fire and EMS response. Same with law enforcement. I mean, they anticipate that when they call, they're going to get someone.
Fair. But you could say, well, if I get a third call, then I'm in the same boat today. So how many calls do you need to be able to handle at once would be a question.
I would think that there is a level of expectation in the public that they understand if you had four calls come in at one time or what have you, that there's going to be some sort of a delay because we can't have a fire station on every block.
Right.
But
so
I think handling,
draw the line.
For me, it's the second call. It's being able to, I mean, if we have, even if we have a first call, a traffic accident that has two patients pinned in the vehicle, we don't have the ability to handle that and transport both of those patients without completely draining our entire resources and calling for additional aid. So, I mean, we have one incident that happens on the Alpine Highway and Tippecanoe Highway, and we've drained our entire resources. Maybe the public's okay with that until someone up in Alpine or upper end of Highland has a medical problem at the same point in time, and now we don't have the ability.
So even with the aid, you're saying a major accident would drain us?
Yes.
And
yeah.
So we couldn't get that second call.
You have an accident with extrication, you get an engine and a ladder truck so you can provide your basic fire suppression and medical care and your extrication needs, and you have an ambulance that comes. That's a typical run-of-the-mill, everyday call that
and
we deal with.
If we just had the six, we couldn't even support that without...
We can't. We'd rely on an additional engine coming from a neighboring community, and we'd rely on an additional ambulance coming to handle that.
So to me, that's the best argument, and that does happen occasionally.
It does, and like I say, the major traffic accident, we have a couple of those a month that would equate to that, but we could have three in a week, or we could go 6 months without something like
or
that.
Or on a snowy day, you could have
yes.
in a day.
And I think that people understand that when you have abnormal weather events and things of that nature, that throws you out of the curve of what normally happens on a sunny day, if you will. But that would kind of be where I'd say the line is. If we compromise service level to a point beyond where I'm suggesting, I think we'll regret our decision. Meaning we aren't meeting the customer needs.
Just while Ramon's walking out, just to follow up on the question, one thing we've asked both chiefs to do is prepare a 5-year capital and personnel plan so we'll have a better understanding of what the costs are moving forward. I mean, the two together is almost $1 million for the district and increase. So I felt like, Shane and I felt like it was important that we had that so we understood what was coming down the road.
That's very good. That'll be very helpful, I think, going forward. And if there are no other questions, we appreciate the work, Chief.
Thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate it. I
hope we didn't slight you this time.
No, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Let me just say, I failed to mention that Shane Sorensen, our administrator from Alpine, is on the phone with us. So, Shane, if you have any questions, you're welcome. We appreciate you taking the time out of your conference to join us.
I'm still here.
Okay, good.
I'm a little disappointed that Shane's online because now we can't say the things we wanted to say behind his back.
There you go.
Okay, Chief.
Good morning, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here again this morning. If you recall, in our last meeting, I had the opportunity to present, like Chief Thompson did this morning. And what I would like to do this morning is just kind of briefly go over what we discussed in our last meeting, and then discuss answer any questions that you might have. So before you, you have the proposed budget for the fiscal year 2019 and 2020. The proposed budget that I'm bringing before you is again $3,677,426. So if you turn to the second page, what I've got before you is the broken down revenue side of it, and you can see each portion that each city is allotted to pay. Again, just a reminder that the police department's allocation of funds is based on population. So you take the total population between the cities of Highland and Alpine and puts a couple of math equations to it, you come out to what we've presented before you, which is Highland would pay as obligated to 64.7% and Alpine to pay 35.3% of the police department's budget.
Chief, we've had presentations from you before indicating that population isn't necessarily the best guide for how many police officers we need. So...
Right, we're talking apples and oranges here. We're talking about funding versus needs of resources.
Right, but if, for example, the type of call that we have in Highland results in a higher usage of time, that would indicate Highland should pay more based on the number of calls as well. You have the number of calls and you have the amount of time it takes.
Correct. Yeah, you remember exactly what we talked about. I think what we have right now is the agreement in the public safety agreement that funding is based on population and not call type or call volume. So that's why we have this broken down. That's a discussion for another time on how we fund the police department, probably the district.
And maybe we should have that conversation when we talk about restructure.
That's a good idea. So as an overall, the total budget increase is $450,963 or 13.9%. If you break that out into each city, it's 14.3% into each city. Now, I'm not a math wizard, and why it's more for each city, I think it has to do with the contributions that we get from the Alpine School District, but to me that would mean it would lessen. So I'm going to be the first to tell you, sometimes I don't trust my math. So I look at Brian because I know he's a lot smarter than I am. But that is 14.3% to each city would be the increase. You saw on the revenue side what those numbers are. So with that said, let me just break this down into what we're asking for. We have an increase in wages, and that increase is to give to bump our starting wage $1.50 an hour to each officer and a 3% merit on top of that. What we want to do is increase the starting wage, and the whole idea behind this budget again is for recruitment and retention. We've had this discussion in the past, and I don't want to belabor the point. I know we're probably under a time crunch this morning. There's a 10% increase in medical benefits in the account number 104520. Retirement is quite a big, large increase of about $135,000. That is to bring the tier two employees up to match what tier one employees are making. Now, I know there's discussion going on Capitol Hill right now with Senate Bill 129, and some of that's going to be fixed, but I don't believe all of it is going to be fixed.
All of it will not be fixed.
The interim of the 9 years of officers that we've hired will not be brought whole. Going forward, hiring officers will come into a new hybrid tier two system, but those that are in the interim are going to be, although the multipliers increased, they're not going to be brought even with the current tier one employees. So
when you say that, is that you're looking at contributions or when you can retire and what you get? Because the tier, and this is simplistic neo-mark, but the tier one was defined benefit, you got X. Tier two was you put it in a 401k-ish type plan.
Right.
And you get whatever the market provides, so that limits the risk on the part of the city. So are you saying the current tier two are going to get moved to a defined benefit? Or are they still just 401k and you're increasing
what
you're providing?
Yeah, that's a great question. I believe it goes back to a defined benefit, but it's not. There's the 9 years where they only earned 1.5% as opposed to 2% as tier one employees did. From my understanding, I was over here reading the bill again this morning, and there's a lot of legalese in there that kind of turns my head sideways. But that is my understanding from how I'm reading it.
So
Brian, maybe you understand it better than I do.
I haven't had a chance to read the changes they made recently. My understanding prior to this was that they're, from a city standpoint, the state was only going to pay a certain amount. We were going to have to cover the difference anyway.
Yes.
And so as a city, as cities, we're going to have to cover some of the increase to put them on an even playing field. That's the expectation. The state is coming back and saying, we're not going to fund this. We're not going to make them even. You as a city are going to have to make them even.
So they're creating, is it an optional or an obligate that we have?
It's a mandate. So they're telling us, you have to make it even, and we're only going to pay a portion of that. And it's an unfunded mandate by the state.
And they're going back to a defined benefit?
Yes, as it was proposed last week. So I haven't seen the recent changes, haven't had a chance to read through any of that.
The only recent change, so at Senator Harper's bill, the change that occurred on, would have been Tuesday, that went back for third reading, Senator McKay substituted the bill, that the only change was, instead of the state weaning the cities back onto that obligation over a 3 to 5 year period, they went to 12 months. That was the change.
And so Senator Fillmore's proposal did not, now, he was going to amend it and take out any, there was a 3.5 or $3.9 million
ongoing,
one-time bump that the state was going to give. He was asking to pull that out, so the state or the cities took everything.
My understanding is that's still there as of Tuesday. Now, whether, and that was the third reading after, if that changed since Tuesday, I don't know.
So, if we went to the, moved away from the defined benefit because it created this huge obligation in the future, is that, and it saved us from going bankrupt at some point in time, is that not the case anymore? I'm asking questions that I sort of know the answer to. The last I read, it was a defined benefit. It was putting into the same pension as everything that was the same as before.
And it was taken out because it created this disastrous financial future.
Nobody does pensions anymore.
Right.
And everybody's moving away from it. That's a state issue that's going to have to be addressed as a global state issue. This is, it can't be argued on this particular bill. It's not going to make any sense. So as a state, you know, we have to look at that. I mean, Social Security is a pension, functionally.
Yes.
But about 50% of companies were offering a pension in the 70s. It's less than 5% today and shrinking. So it's one of those things where everybody recognizes too many people went bankrupt because of the process. Now they're trying to shift away. We as a state have to figure out, but this is not where we can argue it. We just have to deal with what we got and then go back and argue that change as soon as we can.
So this will create an increase next year.
Yes.
Yeah.
That is significant. And so there will be another increase next year, whatever we do.
Well, in that particular category, absolutely. Yeah, in the retirement category, there will be an increase if that gets out of the House. So.
And it appears that it is going to be passed in both the Senate and the House. In some form.
Right.
The liquor tax that portion of it was pulled from it in the House committee yesterday. So the it's out of the Senate and over to the House. So how that's funded is still up for debate.
Yeah, that's been the whole issue all along is you've got an unfunded mandate. Cities are pushing back saying, you're telling us you hate the federal government forcing unfunded mandates down on the state, and you're doing exactly to the cities what you claim is wrong for the federal government, and it's going on, falling on deaf ears. And so that's part of the problem is the cities are pushing back, not because they don't believe that the retirement should happen. They believe it should, but it should be done in a right way. So if you're going to force us into this obligation of a pension, then you should be paying for it. If you want to put it in our hands and give us the flexibility, we'd probably treat it differently. We'd probably go through a 401k or something like that. Who knows? But right. It does need to be fixed. It is unfair. It doesn't work.
Sorry, I got us a little sidetracked there. Moving on, I'm proposing this year that we do there's a 401k match in there, and that's a $74,000 or almost $75,000 increase.
So that's a, they put in, will match up to?
Correct, yeah. So that's.
But if they don't put it in, then we don't.
You don't match it, correct. And it could be up to 5%.
In addition to whatever the state mandates that we do.
That'd be correct, that's correct.
So is that just another effort to recruit and maintain?
Yes, so if you remember last time we discussed options or things that other cities are doing that to recruit and retain employees, and that's one of the,
yeah,
the big ones that especially this generation is looking at is down the road.
Chief, do you have statistics from other cities similar to our size that tell you how many of their officers take advantage of that kind of a benefit?
Not how many, no, I don't have that.
I just wonder if that, if we'll truly end up paying that out or if it's going to be exceeded or?
Well, my experience has been, and maybe Laurie could answer this one a little bit better than I could, but not every officer is putting any money into a 401k. Some are more than 5%. Most of them are significantly less than 5%. I would guess that we would not expend that entire $74,000.
Yeah, that's assuming everybody.
That's assuming everybody takes advantage of the 5%.
So it's a potential surplus area in the budget after,
correct,
at the end of next year.
And then a new vehicle replacement lease of $32,560 is in this budget. So those are the highlights.
Okay.
Those are the big expenses, particularly the wages and the retirement. There's a 10% increase in medical that I put in there. I'm not sure where we're going to land on that. It always seems to be a safe bet. We always come in under that somewhere. 10% typically covers that. So that the medical increase of $40,000 probably won't be the $40,000. That's just to be on the safe side.
What about utility expenses? I see a $5,000 bump there. What's driving that?
So we went to a new phone system. It actually was installed last night and this morning, and there's an increase there with the phones. So
okay.
I know that we get a reimbursement from Alpine School District for the crossing guard program. What are the expenses for the crossing guard?
So we don't, nothing from the crossing guards. We do get a reimbursement for our school resource officers.
Oh, but not for the crossing guards.
Not for the crossing guards.
What is the cost of our crossing guard program?
It's roughly about, if you look under 10, 45, 13, $94,555 is what we pay for crossing guards each year.
So there's $100,000 we could save if we turned that back over to the school district.
By law, I don't think we can. We went down this road about 6 years ago, and we can't. There were members that sat on this board to remember crossing kids when they were in the sixth grade, and we looked at going back to that, and we can't.
They don't seem to be able to turn those lights off. No matter what we do, they can't turn them off.
We've spoken with her. It's hard to find crossing guards. I don't want to do it. I mean.
Well, right. So if we can't get anybody to do it, I guess we don't have the program.
Well, she's crossing, but she's forgetting to turn the lights off. So I'm wondering if we need to get a timer on that.
What if we find the crossing guards? I'm just thinking outside the box here. It's driving me crazy. I drive down, you know, these roads. There's not a school child in sight, not a bus in sight, not a crossing guard in sight, but those lights are going off.
Does it make you drive slower?
Well, it does, yeah. The lights make me drive slower.
I think what he's saying is when it becomes a regular routine thing, you don't, when it's needed, you don't pay attention to it, and you drive in excess of what the school.
I just can't figure it out. I mean, I don't understand. When a school guard shows up, they turn it on. When they leave, they turn it off. It doesn't seem that complicated to me.
So maybe there's a,
you should go try it one
part of their wage. You get half, and then you get half if you fulfill your duties.
It's a tough enforcement problem, I understand.
We'll see what we can continue to do to address that. So, we talk about this every meeting.
I know, and I would think somebody would get tired of it, because I'm tired of talking about it.
I would entertain any questions that you might have.
And then, did you have any, have you given any thought to the more the ability to reflect on our vehicles, police officers, law enforcement, that kind of thing.
We talked about putting something on the bumper last time. Between this and what we're doing with, to answer your question, I haven't looked into that yet.
Okay. So. Any other questions for our chief?
So this does include one additional personnel, right?
No, there are no additional officers in this budget.
Where did I get that?
We did that last year. We added an officer last year.
See, I can't remember to turn off lights, and I can't remember to keep people in the budget.
It's you.
It's me.
The whole focus of my proposal this year is to, again, recruit and retain the officer, the good officers that we do have.
So all the wages are just the increase in starting salaries and other wages to bring them in line, and then, okay.
Yep, it's an increase in starting wage, and it's a 3% merit that would be earned based on a...
Is that a one-time, or will that merit be here next year, too?
My plan is to do a merit each year. The one-time increase for starting wage is a one-time.
Well, it's a one-time issue, and then when wages go up, then it'll be one-time again.
That's the battle that we're facing right now with the pool of applicants being so small. Agencies and cities are raising the wages of their departments.
There's two things going on. One is the starting wage, and two is keeping competent people with the retirement side. So you're battling both pieces of making sure we get the right people.
Well said.
I don't have any more questions.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate the work that both chiefs have done. On this budget. The budgets are always difficult. Nobody likes to raise additional funds, either by fees or taxes. And neither city has this kind of an amount of money to just take it. So we're going to have to figure out how we fund it if we agree with it. I'm sure both chiefs are available. If you have additional questions as you're reviewing the budgets, please take the time to do so.
And I would just note that there is a bill wending through the House and Senate, I don't know where it is right now, that would allow cities to increase a property tax and then have that dedicated to parks or police or fire.
I'm just not a big property tax guy because it's not equally funded. I appreciate that, yeah. But, you know, property tax is another way of redistributing income.
Yes.
And we have people in Highland, I'm sure they have them in Alpine, that have very expensive homes that are still on fixed incomes. They might be retired, they don't have additional income, and so that just reduces their disposable income.
Yes.
And so property tax is not an option for me. There are folks out there who think that because you have a bigger house, you can afford more, and so you should pay more.
So
I'm not one of those people.
Just from a process and procedure standpoint, so the next step would be for the representatives of the two cities to go back to their councils and decide how much money is available for public safety out of our budgets. We need that decision from a district standpoint by mid-April at the latest, because we've got to pass preliminary budgets in May and then the final in June. So we basically have a month and a half, maybe two at tops, to determine how much available funding is there.
And I guess from my standpoint, as a councilman from Highland, and I think the Alpine folks would feel the same way, we need to understand if there is some amount of money that we could afford, and then what additional funding we would have to find funding for the additional amount. And so, Shane, I think your council will probably want to know the same thing. We just need to know what is available and then what additional funding we're going to have to come up with.
I would look at it just a little bit different. I believe that moving forward, any increases that we talk about need to go to the residents and say...
Any increase?
Any increase. All increases moving forward go to the residents, and we say, look, here is the cost of maintaining this public safety. We're not going to continue to subsidize it out of our general fund. If you want this level of service, this is where it's going to be. You want to fight it, this is the cost of maintaining where we're at. If you don't want that, then we're going to reduce that, but...
Okay, and that's the argument that each city council is going to have, and I totally understand where you're coming from. That makes sense. But just so that we have all the information so that we can discuss it properly, we need to know if there is additional, some additional funding that we could take out of the general fund, or if we want to do in fact what you're suggesting and have every increase be a property tax increase or a fee for public safety. So that's a discussion that each city council is going to have, and they're going to have it on their own. And what I'm hearing from Nathan is we need to have that before mid-April. Okay. Any other comments? Then we need to, we have one item on the agenda for the fire department with regard to an offline medical director contract.
And that's replacing one that's leaving.
So right. This is not an increase in the budget. This is just replacing one.
Thank you. Yes, and there was a couple of questions about that last night. Between Nathan and I, hopefully we answered some of those questions. We are required in order to run a paramedic rescue and ground ambulance service to have an offline medical director that helps with our training and competency of our emergency medical personnel, in addition to the narcotics and other medications we are authorized to carry. That's operated under the medical director's license. Dr. Van Wagner, who's been performing those services for us, has had some changes in his life that he's indicated he's unable to continue in his current capacity. He reached out to me at the end of January, and so through that process we've interviewed candidates and have selected an individual, Cabe Cowan. He's a physician in the emergency department at American Fork Hospital. And we have drafted an offline medical director agreement. There was an agreement in the past that was not quite as robust as the one that's here. The intent behind this was to clearly define what his responsibilities are and what we would essentially get for our professional and technical services that he's providing. So the exhibit addresses that, and then we've also included a business associate agreement, which is a recommendation based on our billing company to have that move forward in that direction. I feel like we have a good candidate that will do a great job for us, and due to the amount of money that's involved in that annually, I just figured it was important to be transparent and bring that before the board for approval.
I might mention that the chief has done quite a bit of homework on this. He also met with Mountain Point Hospital to discuss the possibility of developing a relationship there. Not timely at this point, but maybe sometime in the future as we get closer to having them be receiving more and more of our patients.
Yeah, the balance of transports currently is the greater portion is going to American Fork Hospital, and so we feel like there's validity and some importance in maintaining where we send most of our patients and getting that feedback from that medical director and their associate staff. We continue to work with all of the hospitals and like the feedback we received there, but at this time felt like that was the right direction for our district to go.
And I think it's really good that we develop those relationships between the hospitals, and I was not aware that was something that was going on already, so really positive.
Some of those hospitals are reaching out to the cities. I'm sure you've been contacted, I have as well, to spend time with them, and they're anxious to become part of our communities, and it's all about profit for them too, so they're networking, and but it does open up the door for us to
draw from some resources that may not have been there before. Chief, I was just curious about the position itself. Now, so I know Scott is an ER doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Is that kind of the criteria, or are you looking, do you hire any type of medical professional who's a licensed physician to provide those services for us?
The administrative rules through the Bureau of EMS won't require it be an emergency physician. It has to be a medical doctor. That said, we feel like based on the type of work that we are doing in the pre-hospital setting and coordinating that through through hospitals, we have offline and online medical directions. So the online would take place on every call. We contact the hospital prior to making the transport and ask for any orders that they have relevant to medications we may push on scene or things of that nature. We feel like having someone that's an emergency physician is paramount because we get good feedback, we get training in the emergency room, I guess dialogue, if you will, and the upcoming trends and data that's coming out of the American Medical Association and things like that relevant to emergency medicine. We just feel like that's the right fit. But it's not a mandate to have a emergency room doctor. We just feel that's a best practice.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. I also think they can build a relationship with some of these individuals that we send down there, to your point earlier about where we send most of the traffic. They'll have some engagement if they're on duty and we send patients to them.
Yeah, there is, and it's been helpful at both facilities to have a working relationship there, but certainly as if we have an issue that does come up or a way we can do business better, to have that relationship with an emergency room physician is very beneficial.
One of the things I found out is that the Mountain Point Hospital has a better cardiac equipment.
Andy.
And so most of our cardiac patients are going to go there versus American Fork. So, you know, there's a lot to learn.
Yeah, we try to stay up on that and make sure that we're helping the patient make an informed decision when they go on a transport. Some of that's dictated by a closest facility based on the symptoms or signs that we get when we arrive on scene.
So how did you know, Tim, that they had better cardiac there? Are you checking out the hospitals for some particular reason?
I was in the meeting.
All right.
Okay. Any other questions for the chief? Then I would...
I would move that we approve the offline medical director contract as presented to us by Chief Thompson.
I would second that motion.
It's been moved by Mayor Mann and seconded by Mayor Stout. Any further discussion? Let's just take a roll call, Brian.
Yes.
Mayor?
Yes. Mayor?
Stout says yes. Mann says yes.
And the chair says yes. It's unanimous. Thank you very much,
Thank
Chief.
You.
We do not have minutes for approval today, so I would entertain a
move to adjourn.
Second.
Moved and seconded to adjourn. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
We are adjourned. Thank you, Shane, for joining us.
You